From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The U.S. and China strike an historic climate change deal. President Obama at a press conference in Beijing Wednesday.
We hope to encourage all major economies to be ambitious. All countries, developing and developed, to work across some of the old divides so we can conclude a strong global climate agreement next year.
Pipeline politics. The Senate readies a vote on Keystone, a key issue in the one undecided U.S. Senate race. Here's the embattled Democratic incumbent Mary Landrieu of Louisiana.
This project has cleared every environmental hurdle and it has met the complete environmental review. It has the support of about 35 to 40 key organizations.
And the European Space Agency successfully landed a spacecraft on a comet 317 million miles away, traveling 40,000 miles an hour. Here the scientists celebrate.
The flywheel is going down, which it should do, of course. We are there. It's done its job. We are on the comet.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Margaret Taleb from Bloomberg News, Michael Hirsch from Politico Magazine, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online. Is President Obama coming back? Can Republicans stop him? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Margaret Taleb, White House correspondent from Bloomberg News. Margaret, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, John. Nice to be here. Thanks.
Also from Washington, Michael Hirsch, the national editor of Politico Magazine. Michael, thanks for being with us.
Hi, John. How are you?
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, John, Margaret, and Michael.
Let me start, Jack, by asking you. Last week, President Obama got hammered in the election. His party lost the Senate. They lost seats in the House. The electorate said they were trying to send a message to him. And yet this week, we see the president stepping out on net neutrality, stepping out or preparing to step out on immigration, stepping out on climate change. What does that mean? Is he not a lame duck, in fact?
Well, John, you know, when President Obama arrived in China, the Financial Times reported the Chinese soldiers, forming a corridor off Air Force One, they were all taller than Mr. Obama. But our 6-foot-1-inch president would not be diminished. You know, a week after the midterms really left him a Lilliputian in Washington, he stood tall in Beijing. A headline referencing the reception that Asian business leaders gave him, it recalled the hope and change days as a candidate in 2008. Here's the headline, "Rockstar Obama keeps other leaders firmly in his slipstream." His loftiest performance, a promise really of 2008, came in Mile High Denver when he said historians would see his election, quote, as the moment when the rise of the oceans began to slow. Mitt Romney mocked that line in 2012. But if this U.S.-China agreement spurs common action at next year's climate change meeting in Paris, you know, then our dry posterity will see the president as the future's champion, fighting for them against bot politicians and a media glued to the glass of now.
Michael Hirsch, the president's taken a lot of heat lately for his foreign policy decision making with respect to the Islamic State and Syria and Iraq. His foreign policy team has taken a lot of heat for not functioning effectively. Did any of what happened this week change any of those assessments, or was this an outlier that was really off topic and environmentally focused agreement that he could strike that isn't really about him working with other countries except for China?
You know, John, I think to a remarkable extent, picking up on what Jack just said, this was Obama's week, which is, you know, incredibly striking considering the results of the midterm elections. It wasn't just this climate deal with China, which I would add was in the works for some time. You could tell that the Obama team, knowing they were about to face a huge midterm defeat, were preparing this big deal, and it was quite, a big and important announcement, despite the drawbacks of this understanding. Just the fact that the U.S. and Chinese got together on this when only a few years ago in Copenhagen, Obama literally had to go, trouncing through a hotel to find the Chinese leader who was meeting secretly with other leaders to undercut Obama.
Break into their room.
Yeah, exactly. So that was very dramatic. And you also had a somewhat embarrassing moment for Vladimir Putin, who has made no secret of the fact that he is wooing the Chinese very eagerly, because Putin is on the outs, of course, with the rest of the Western powers after his moves in Ukraine. You know, he was sort of embarrassed at this dinner when he put his jacket on the Chinese president's wife, and she immediately took it off. So the optics of this week have really all gone Obama's way, and you really have to give him credit. He does not look like a lame duck at the moment.
Margaret, did anything about the events of this week surprise you, having seen the president's news conference at the end of last week after the elections?
I don't know if surprise is the right word, but I do think that on the opening day of the return to the lame duck session, when we saw Mary Landrieu's push on Keystone and the conflict inside the Democratic Party that obviously sets up, that you understand the context in which President Obama is acting. I don't see him as particularly empowered or operating from a position of strength so much as he is liberated now from trying to have to put what he wants aside to try to protect his party's control of the Senate. So, I mean, that's gone. And now he's swinging for the fences. He's got 2 years to try to cement the fairly modest legacy he has in terms of volume of accomplishments. Some of the accomplishments themselves could have huge implications if he can solidify them, if he can sort of fill them out. And the two tracks that are sort of in play now are immigration and health care, of course. And that's what he's moving to do. And then you see on immigration, which could be sort of the third thing, right, that he does, that he has concluded, and he had already concluded before, that there's no upside to waiting. So, but it's not like he has this huge wave of public and political support that's, you know, sort of in any way clearly behind him. He has polling that indicates that Americans will support X, Y, and Z. But he's operating from this very murky political position on a pretty tenuous perch. And the only reason he's doing so with gusto is because he has nothing left to lose.
So you're not ready to go as far as Jack and Michael with the Obama is back thing.
Well, I mean, he's back because what's his alternative? But it's not like the Republicans are going to say, oh, wow, you know what? Never mind. We're just going to get in line and does what he says to do. He has made a decision to set up this fight now. Maybe it's not a fight. I mean, he's made a decision to do what he can do without them now. And that will have implications, and it will set up a pretty rocky next couple of years.
I want to get into the discussion of climate by starting with some words from the president himself. At a joint press conference with Chinese President Xi Jinping on Wednesday, President Obama said the agreement between the two countries to slow climate change is based on joint responsibility.
As the world's two largest economies, energy consumers, and emitters of greenhouse gases, we have a special responsibility to lead the global effort against climate change. That's why today I am proud that we can announce a historic agreement. I commend President Xi, his team, and the Chinese government for the commitment they are making to slow, peak, and then reverse the course of China's carbon emissions.
Michael Hirsch, this is a non-binding agreement that has provoked significant criticism and outrage from Republicans. We've got another presidential election coming up in 2 years, which could go to the Republican Party. How do we know if this deal is a big deal or not, or simply a temporary announcement that could blow away?
Well, we don't know for sure. We do know that it's remarkable that the U.S. and China got together on this in the way they did. Of course, critics, particularly on the Republican side, immediately focus on what appear to be some, you know, very non-stringent restrictions on the part of the Chinese, commitments on the part of the Chinese, in terms of, you know, they're going to be allowed to continue their carbon emissions for another 16 years, aiming for a peak moment, and then only then to cut 20% of fossil fuel emissions, or actually, I should say, the amount of their energy based on fossil fuel. So it's a far less stringent requirement for the Chinese than it is for the U.S. Although I should add that on to credit Obama, he also did not require did not agree to restrictions that are anything as severe as what the European Union has imposed on itself. But I think it was very significant in that this agreement was an acknowledgement that, look, the United States and China are at different places in terms of development. You know, China is still a developing country. This has been the crux of what has prevented any kind of a global climate deal between these two powers and other major powers, is this failure to take into account the fact that these countries are at different stages of development. Jack, so I think this does set things up nicely for Paris in 2015.
Jack Beatty, I want to play a little clip and get you to react quickly. In his office on Wednesday, Republican Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said he was particularly distressed about the climate deal between the U.S. and China.
As I read the agreement, requires the Chinese to do nothing at all for 16 years while these carbon emission regulations are creating havoc in my state and other states around the country.
Jack Beatty, quickly, can Republicans stop this agreement?
I don't know. I think the president wants to do it as an executive agreement and not have any treaty part of this. But you know, essentially the Republicans have been deprived of one of their best arguments against movement on climate change. China won't move, they said. China is now moving.
They do appear to be moving. Stay right there, Jack Beatty, Margaret Taleb, Michael Hirsch. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We're talking about the week in the news, Russian troops moving into Ukraine, looming policy shifts on immigration and internet neutrality, and Obamacare back at the Supreme Court. We're joined by Margaret Taleb from Bloomberg News, Michael Hirsch from Politico Magazine, and our own Jack Beatty. I want to start by playing a clip that caused a little sizzle this week as Obamacare heads back for a very controversial Supreme Court case. It comes from Jonathan Gruber. He was an MIT professor. He was a consultant on the Romney Care in Massachusetts, then a consultant on the Affordable Care Act. Speaking in October 2013 at the University of Pennsylvania, he talked about the act's lack of transparency.
Lack of transparency is a huge political advantage. And basically, you know, call it the stupidity of the American voter or whatever. But basically, that was really, really critical to getting the thing to pass. And, you know, it's the second best argument. Look, I wish Mark was right. We can make it all transparent. But I'd rather have this law than not. So it's kind of like his reporter story. You know, yeah, there's things I wish I could change, but I'd rather have this law than not.
So, Margaret, who's stupid here? The American voters, the lawmakers who voted for the act, the media, or John Gruber?
I'm not sure he should have said it, but it kind of unlocks the code to modern politics and the Obama administration. You know, the outward play is we're going to be the most.
Wait, I haven't unlocked the code yet. Can you please unlock it for me?
Well, I think he started to. I mean, look, it is this duality of talking about the importance of transparency while acting within the margins. I mean, you know, you just. What he's saying is right to some extent, right? It's easier to get stuff done when everybody doesn't get to look at all of the sausage, and sometimes you're not looking at it because it's purposefully.
But wait, didn't people look
hidden.
At the sausage when this law was debated? It seems to me there was a fair amount of controversy about it at the time and continuously since then.
I think that the point stands, which is that people don't always ask enough questions, and when political operations take advantage of that, it allows them more ease to sort of maneuver things into the place where they want them to be, you know. But yeah, it's crazy. I mean, why would you stir up a controversy like that for no reason? It brings all of this attention onto this issue that you know, already is so polarizing and negative. And it's not it wouldn't be a good predicate for like launching your own political campaign to talk like that.
Jack Beatty, let me ask you. Are John Gruber's comments evidence that Obamacare is some sort of scam?
Well, you know, John, really, it's the politician's prayer. Oh, that mine enemy would hire a professor. I mean, you know, you can count on his indiscretion, bank on his arrogance. No sentient citizen in 2009-10 could have missed it. The Democrats planned to tax people who didn't sign up for Obamacare. But they labeled it a fine to avoid podium. Now, conservatives are calling this routine, and I think it is routine, congressional spin, which Gruber deplores on tape, as a sort of revelation of perfidious liberalism. The right's reaction to leaky Gruber, and here we have Charles Krauthammer, the true voice of liberal arrogance, it really smacks of ginned-up indignation. This week's Benghazi. Professor Gruber is gold to the GOP. They'll mine him for months.
Michael Hirsch, we have these flapdoodles every once in a while when remarks that are captured in ostensibly private settings get leaked and people make a big deal out of them. This happened a couple of weeks ago when Hillary Clinton said something on the stump about businesses not being responsible for creating jobs, and she was attacked. Is this consequential? Is this going to change the debate? Do you think it's important?
No, I don't, because this is not Hillary Clinton. This is Jonathan Gruber, who is a very substantive thinker, clearly, as you said in your intro, responsible for not only Obamacare, but Romneycare before it in terms of many of its major provisions. But let's face it, he's not a public figure. This is not like playing and replaying without end, you know, Mitt Romney's infamous 47% comments in the 2012 election. This is a guy that most people don't know who he is. He's a wonk, an MIT professor. So I don't see that this particular situation, I mean, his comments were clearly controversial. It's just that he's not directly connected with the Obama administration.
And it doesn't fundamentally change, you know, the fact that this law has ensured a whole bunch of new people, and that to really try to do anything substantively to undo that, you're looking at taking insurance coverage away from people. And that has always been and remains to be the real problem for Republicans who actually want to undo this.
Well, now it's a problem, Jack Beatty, for the Supreme Court, because they have taken a case that would eliminate, if the plaintiff's argument was sustained, would eliminate subsidies in the 36 states that have not set up their own exchanges. Do you think they're prepared to do that?
Well, you know, it would be a real challenge to American democracy if they did. That's because, as Linda Greenhouse points out now, she identifies herself as a progressive, so that should be said. But she was for years the Pulitzer Prize-winning court reporter for the New York Times. And in a tough piece this week, Law in the Raw, she says that she's tired now and will not continue to defend the court against people who say it's political. She says it is political.
She called it worse than Bush versus Gore.
Worse than Bush versus Gore. And that's partly because there is a well-established principle of deference that's enshrined in a 1984 decision that, in fact, it's cited in something like 1,000 cases a year, that decision. And this decision basically says if there's ambiguity in a regulation, the courts leave it up to the agency's interpretation to say what it means. In this case, the IRS said that the tax credits should be available without regard to whether the exchange is state or federal. So here's this long-standing court decision and standard that implicitly is being breached, at least by four justices. And she sort of looks at Justice Roberts and says, you know, is he now coming under pressure from his conservative colleagues and the reference groups he's familiar with, the Federalist Society and others, to be the man who saved Obamacare, be the man who slays it?
Potentially some peer pressure going on. I want to shift gears right now. At a news conference in Bulgaria on Wednesday, top NATO commander General Philip Breedlove confirmed that Russian troops have been seen crossing over the border into Ukraine.
We have seen columns of Russian equipment, primarily Russian tanks, Russian artillery, Russian air defense systems, and Russian combat troops entering into Ukraine.
Michael Hirsch, what's the significance of that?
Well, for the first time, you have a high-level NATO official saying that what Russia has been denying it's been up to is actually happening, which is, you know, you've had essentially Russian surrogates fighting in eastern Ukraine supplied by Moscow, but without acknowledgement from Moscow and without it being plainly Russian troops. Now you have what is, in effect, a Russian takeover of that part of Ukraine, which, you know, raises the sort of nightmarish memories of, you know, Czechoslovakia in 1968 or Hungary in 1956, although clearly not on the same scale. You have what appears to be an effort by Vladimir Putin to try to resurrect at least a part of the Iron Curtain of the Cold War. And so it's alarming in the extreme. And there's also a recent interview in which a Duma member who's very close to Putin suggested that a couple of the Baltic states, Latvia and Estonia, might be under threat as well. So this continues to be a very, very serious situation.
All right. We got some more news popping, which is the president's preparing, we don't know exactly when it's going to happen, to issue an executive order on immigration that could give legal status to several million people who are now in the country illegally. Republicans don't like it. Republican Speaker of the House John Boehner said Republicans will fight, quote, tooth and nail against President Obama's promise of executive amnesty.
The president is threatening to take unilateral action on immigration, even though in the past he's made clear he didn't believe he had the constitutional responsibility or authority to do that. And I'll just say this. We're going to fight the president tooth and nail if he continues down this path.
Margaret Taleb, how does the White House factor in that threat?
With a shrug. I mean, this is something that President Obama has been talking about doing since, the campaign in 2007. He punted it all the way through his first term. He's deep into the second term. Dissatisfaction among Latino advocacy groups with him is very high. And he has got, again, his own legacy to cement and Hillary Clinton's run in 2016 to set up. And he has decided to go forward with this. He had decided it already over the summer. They waited again to try to help those moderate Democrats in tight Senate races. It didn't matter. It didn't work. It didn't help. And now they're going forward. And I would look for this, you know, maybe not before Thanksgiving, maybe first week or so in December, first couple of weeks in December. But they're going forward with this. And, I think that the White House's calculation is that politically it's more of an upside than it is a downside for them.
All right, let's go to the phones.
For the party.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Mark on the line from Suffolk, New York. Mark, welcome to On Point. Go right ahead.
Hi, John. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to know, the president didn't hear anything during the midterm elections. The entire country spoke out, and we do not want amnesty. We do not want to put $500 billion a year to take care of anchor babies and illegals every year. We don't want that. We want them all to be deported.
Mark, thanks so much for your call. Jack Beatty, is there something wrong with the president's ears?
Well, I'm not. I didn't hear what Mark said. I mean, I didn't hear the voters saying that. I mean, polls are all over the lot on this. And I'm not. It isn't as if the Democrats were making it an issue. They were running from it. So I don't think that's a fair estimation of what the electorate says. It may be what he thinks and what people he knows thinks, but it's hard to look at the polls, which even I have seen polls that even show a slight majority of Republican voters favored the comprehensive immigration bill in the Senate, which passed the Senate with bipartisan approval. So it's not clear that he's defying the voters so much as he is undoubtedly defying the activist base of the GOP.
All right, let's go to a different topic. The Keystone Pipeline is heating up. Of course, we've got a Senate race in Louisiana. You've got a House member, Republican, pushing the House, which will vote today, to authorize the pipeline. Mary Landrieu, his opponent in the December runoff, has lined up a Senate vote on Tuesday. And Joe Manchin, the Democratic senator from West Virginia, spoke out in support of this, saying it's a good opportunity in the lame duck Congress to get something done.
It's time for us to start working together. There's not a better piece of legislation to show that we heard the results of Tuesday's election. We heard it. And if you heard nothing more from that roar of Americans, whether they voted or didn't vote, they basically told us, do something.
Michael Hirsch, is that the message of the election? Get something done, and this is the issue?
I don't think that the White House sees it that way. Again, along the lines of this theme we've been sketching out of a president who in his final 2 years is going to decide to do what he wants on his own and take a lot of executive action. And Margaret may know more about this than I do, but the signals coming from the White House are that he's not ready to sign this deal for the Keystone Pipeline. You have circumstances changing, which really kind of take away from the argument for the pipeline, which is a decline in oil prices, as well as an increase in jobs. So, you know, those were two of the key arguments you had all along for the Keystone Pipeline. So there's perhaps a little bit of an edge off of that argument. And I don't see the president very eager to sign this. It may have to come to a veto fight.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got David on the line from Woodbury, Connecticut. David, go right ahead.
Oh, hi, John, everybody. Thanks for taking the call. Gosh, as regards to the Keystone Pipeline, our President Barack Obama put it best this morning. I heard them this morning. Why should we pump Canadian oil down, clear down to the Gulf Coast just to have it exported? And that's about it.
David, thanks so much for your call. Margaret Talev, the president has said that. On the other hand, I don't know about you, but I expect him to go along with Congress if, in fact, they vote to authorize the Keystone Pipeline. Do you? And if so, why?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting because they haven't issued a formal veto threat. They've sort of hinted at the idea that that he might sort of have to on just on principle because I think because they consider it an executive decision up to the State Department waiting for this court to weigh in. But the irony of all of it is that based on both the administration's public comments and you know, sort of private conversations that we've all been hearing over the last year at least, this is not actually like the biggest deal to President Obama one way or the other.
He doesn't think it's
right?
that important.
No, that's exactly right. And I mean, you know, he thinks it's probably like not the greatest thing for the environment, also probably not the greatest job creator, that all of this is overstated, and that really in terms of like what defines the environmental future of the earth or whatever, it's not the Keystone Pipeline. And so you're going to see this big, you know, explosive fight in Congress. And you know, I think part of the reason why they haven't issued a formal veto threat is they may be waiting to see what that vote actually looks like when the Democrats go on the board. If the overwhelming majority of the Democratic Senate like votes
Which
for this,
goes for it.
What Look, is he doing? You know, and he, so it. But it's
here's yeah. a different topic, Margaret, because we're rocketing on a lot of news this week that the president clearly does think it's important. In a video statement the president released, he asked the Federal Communications Commission to adopt strict net neutrality rules to prevent broadband companies from blocking or slowing down content or allowing content providers to pay for fast lane service to customers.
The public has already commented nearly 4 million times asking the FCC to make sure that consumers, not the cable company, gets to decide which sites they use. Americans are making their voices heard and standing up for the principles that make the Internet a powerful force for change. As long as I'm president, that's what I'll be fighting for, too.
Jack Beatty, is this the president trying to strong-arm an independent agency? And if so, is he going to succeed?
Well, from what I've read, the since he's appointed a majority, or the Democrats have appointed a majority of the commission, this is a message to them they can't they can't mistake, and that yes, they're an independent.
Can they ignore it?
There have been some ambiguous statements in that regard. Tom Wheeler, the chairman out in Silicon Valley, was saying the other day, well, he's open to net neutrality, which is quite a surprise.
And he was appointed by the president.
Yeah, that's right. And he was opposed to it just, well, yesterday. So we'll have to see.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. In other news this week, snow buried the Midwest in an unusually early winter storm. This woman from Colorado is ready.
I'm as prepared as I'll ever be. Got the coats, got the gloves, got the scarves, the boots.
NBC weatherman Al Roker set a new Guinness World Record for the longest uninterrupted weather forecast, 34 hours.
So here's what's happening. Little Rock is going to be 29 degrees tonight.
Mid-Atlantic and on into the southeast.
Memphis is only going to be 29.
San Antonio tonight. You're a little on the chilly side.
And 25 years after the Berlin Wall fell, we remember how they cheered when the East Germans broke through. You can join the conversation. Have you heard about the disturbing allegations against America's dad, Bill Cosby? Have you seen the way Kim Kardashian tried to break the Internet? And Chelsea Handler's answer? Admit it, you have. We're joined by Margaret Talev from Bloomberg News, Michael Hirsch from Politico Magazine, and our own Jack Beatty. Michael Hirsch, you heard the cheering at the Berlin Wall as we observe the 25th anniversary. Reflections on what's happened in those 25 years?
Well, you know, it's an interesting juxtaposition, John. The 25th anniversary was last Sunday, and then, of course, later this week, we had these new diary reports of Russian tanks and troops trying to repeat parts of the Cold War, the second time of his farce, if you will, by taking over formally parts of eastern Ukraine. And
Putin, turn around those tanks.
There you go. But I think it helps us to have some perspective on this. The fact is, 25 years later, the former Warsaw Pact countries are, most of them, Eastern European countries, from Poland to the Czech Republic and the Baltic states, are free and thriving economies, part of the European Union, in most cases part of NATO. So you do have a very enduring legacy there that suggests that what Putin is trying to do in turning back the clock is really just going to be, you know, kind of a drop in the bucket. It's not going to substantially change this historical trend we've seen.
Jack Beatty, you are the furthest north of any panelist on this hour. So I want to see if you've got any advance word for us on the polar vortex and whether the hype that we're seeing, it's been leading network newscasts, is something that concerns you, or do you dismiss it?
Well, it concerns me. There was a frost on our sort of a rime of frost on the porch this morning, and the Vermont traffic report was hazardous roads. Now, we usually don't hear that. Well, at least until December. So
the snow we were supposed to get overnight in Boston turned out to be kind of a dud.
Yeah, but up here it became a kind of breath of black ice, which is what happens, and makes the roads very treacherous. So we're hearing that even before Thanksgiving. So yeah, we're worried about it.
Margaret, you have lived for some time in California. How does that polar vortex feel to you? And now that you're in Washington.
I hate the cold weather. It's just like my least favorite time. Everyone talks about how much they love fall in Washington because of the leaves. But when you know what's coming next, it's just like, but I am proud of myself because I went to Target about 2 weeks ago and bought up like a bazillion bags of, you know, salt. Because what happens in Washington is it's just in that spot where people don't really think it's going to get cold. And so nobody orders enough salt. And then it snows and, you know, by December, they're sold out for the rest of the year. So I'm ready. I've got marshmallows at home. I've got waxy, fake fire logs, and I've got ice.
By the way, you're in Washington now, correct?
I am.
Why did you skip that $70,000 trip to Asia with the president? For listeners who don't know what I'm talking about, I used to cover the White House for the Wall Street Journal, and we would routinely go on whatever trip the president went on. But given the shifting dynamics of and diminishing profitability of news organizations, fewer are traveling, which means the cost for each news organization that goes is huge because they charter planes and carry us around. I have to say, Margaret, I was stunned to see this $70,000 price tag on this trip.
It's actually a staggering cost. I mean, Bloomberg always staffs presidential trips. It wasn't my turn. I got to go to Burma in 2012. It was amazing. I would have loved to have done this trip, but because it was right after the midterms, I stayed here to cover the implications of the midterms. But we do have two reporters on that trip, but it is incredibly expensive. And I think in the next couple of years, we're going to see both because people's resources need to be marshaled to cover 2016 and because the president's importance as a American and world political figure will diminish as it does with all lame duck presidents. A real balancing act as news organizations try to figure out how they can afford. I mean, it's so important. Covering a president is really very important to helping Americans understand what's going on in the world.
And fewer organizations are capable of doing it.
Yes.
Let's go to a different topic. On Wednesday, the European Space Agency made history when their I don't know how to pronounce this right. Philae Lander became the first human-made spacecraft to land somewhat successfully on a comet. Lead Lander scientist Jean-Pierre Bibring described a technical issue at a news conference on Thursday.
We wanted to land. We landed. Then we rebounced. even more than what we thought yesterday. Actually, from the science data we collected up to yesterday evening, we understood that we had three flops like that, and finally we rebounded two times and finally stopped.
Michael Hirsch, let's think about that for a second. 317 million miles away, landing a craft, sort of, on a comet that's 2 miles wide and traveling 40,000 miles an hour. It's astonishing.
It is astonishing. And I think, you know, for Americans, there's something poignant about the fact that it's the Europeans who did it. You know, one of our more popular phrases in this country since 1969 is, you know, if you can land a man on the moon, why can't you do such and such? So I guess in Europe, they're going to start saying, if you can land on a comet, why can't we get our economy going again or so? But, you know,
clearly, this is not inspiring, though, the reaction that, say, Sputnik did in the late 50s when somebody other than us did it. We happened to be in a Cold War at that time.
Yeah.
Do you think Americans care that Europeans did it and not us?
Not a whole lot, I don't think. But, you know, this mission is just absolutely fascinating. On beyond the landing, apparently we are now in a matter of hours before the batteries on this probe die, and they're kind of in a race to see whether they can get the data they want to get on comets. We know nothing about comets in actuality. Apparently, because of this bumpy landing, the craft ended up in a shadowy spot and so could not use its solar panel. So there's actually quite a drama going on that little speck 300 million miles away.
But I love this story. I love the story. I think it's so optimistic at a time when it looks like nobody can get anything done here in the U.S. politically. The idea that you can shoot something off into space 10 years ago and it can travel like bazillions of miles. I think that's an actual distance. And even the prospect of unlocking the mysteries of the world is just like an incredibly feel-good story.
Are you saying, Margaret, that the European Space Agency is less dysfunctional than Washington?
So you're trying to put me in a box there, and I'm not going to do that. But I am thinking about opening a bar called 67P because I feel like that would be really awesome.
Maybe we should just say less dysfunctional than NASA, which
that's right.
Arguably true.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We've got Patty on the line from Columbia, South Carolina. Patty, welcome to the show. Go right ahead.
Hi, John. I just wanted to say, yes, if our scientific community is capable of landing a craft on a comet, why can't we just take their word about climate change?
Patty, thanks so much for the call. Jack Beatty, what about it? Or maybe the landing was a hoax.
Yeah, maybe along with the moon landing of two generations ago. You know, taking their word for it, I mean, that really is something. I don't know whether this is accurate or not, but I have seen a news, I think it was a news report, that on the House Science Committee, a majority, even 70, as much as 70% of the Republican members are climate change deniers. That's really, you know, they're not taking their word for it. They're saying no. And now the new chairman, Jim Inhofe of the Senate, of the comparable Senate committee, Environmental Committee, he is an uber denialist. He goes so far as to say it's a plot, you know, spawned by scientists all over the world to fill us with this job-killing notion of the planet's future demise. So it would be great if we could take it, if we could take science on its word. And you know, one of the now standard lines that denying politicians use is, "I'm not a scientist." Well, they're not a scientist when it comes to gravity, but they accept that. Not a scientist when it comes to the comet, you know, the landing on the comet, but they accept that that happened, but not climate change.
All right, let's take another call. We've got Mike on the line from St. Paul, Minnesota. Mike, welcome to On Point, and go right ahead.
Hi. You were talking about the comet landing, and it just strikes me that it was last week there have been these stories about some of the privatized functions of American space flight, really horrific stories, some setbacks. I suppose Richard Branson is an American, but it's the case, I think, that NASA has been privatizing some of its functions lately, and there have been some bad stories associated with that. But over, you mentioned, what do Americans think about seeing the success of a European space program? This is a great success, but I think it's still in the model of a NASA that keeps its operations in within the government purview. So that's what.
Mike, thanks so much for your call. Michael Hirsch?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are broader questions about the defunding of NASA, the undermining of the U.S. space program, the fact that we've had to latch on to the Russians for their rockets, which is rather uncomfortable in the midst of this this quasi-Cold War that's developed. I think that this president probably isn't going to get to it. He's got too much on his plate, and he's only got 2 years. But I think it becomes a very, very serious question for the next president.
Now, I'm neither a scientist nor a police officer, but I do know that in the middle of the country, in Missouri, outside of St. Louis, people in Ferguson are bracing for the results of investigations both locally and in Washington at the Justice Department about the death of Michael Brown. At a press conference on Thursday, a lawyer for Michael Brown's family, Anthony Gray, asked that demonstrators and police refrain from acts of violence once the grand jury announces its decision sometime this month.
We want to make it very clear that on behalf of the Brown family, we do not condone any acts of rioting, looting, or violence, and that we want to encourage all of those that support the justice for Mike Brown to remain vigilant, yet peaceful.
Margaret Talib, how much is the White House worried about what's going to happen?
They're paying very close attention. I remember a couple of weeks before the midterm election, sitting down with White House officials to talk about what's your agenda for the lame duck session and what are you watching between now and then the end of the year. And even though this really has nothing to do with the lame duck session, the outcome of this and the implications in Ferguson was toward the top of their list of things they're monitoring.
Jack Beatty, is it not clear from the stories that have come out from investigators both on the ground in Ferguson as well as at the Justice Department in Washington that the evidence appears ambiguous enough that it will be exceedingly difficult to charge Michael Darren Wilson, the police officer, with a crime?
Yes, I mean, that has been the drift of things. It's almost as if the leaks, either from the Justice Department or from Missouri people, have been an effort to sort of immunize and prepare the public for what's to come. I was really struck.
Will that work?
I don't know. I certainly hope so. You know, there's been a kind, I mean, properly we focus on this story. Properly, the overreaction of the police was universally condemned. On the other hand, there has been a subtext of legitimation going on, and even media figures have been not condoning, but all but, you know, saying, "Oh well, there's only been a little violence. Let's overlook that." That's treacherous, and I'm afraid that kind of I don't know what to call it, propaganda, that sort of legitimation. I'm afraid some of that might have been heard, and who knows what's going to happen.
All right. At the risk of improperly legitimizing something else, I'm going to simply have to wade into the Kardashian controversy this week. Margaret Talib, Kim Kardashian, who's famous for being famous, has come up with a new way by pulling down her dress, posing with a bare backside, balancing a champagne glass on her rear end, which was then promptly matched by Chelsea Handler, who, of course, has had a very popular late-night show. Draw some conclusions. Give us some wisdom about what this tells us about American popular culture.
That we thought we'd hit the bottom, but we hadn't really. I mean, I actually was just talking about this with a friend last night. I don't really get it, and maybe that makes me old and lame or super nerdy, but I just... Ugh, you know, right? And actually, if I understand the controversy right, and I really am horrified that I'm going there, I think it was the front that was even more controversial than the back, right? Okay. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. People care. I don't know why. I don't care.
Jack Beatty, I was at a White House Correspondents' Dinner. This shows you how whacked out our Washington culture is. I was seated next to Chelsea Handler at a White House Correspondents' Dinner a couple of years ago. I was aware that my daughters were watching her raunchy show, and I said, Chelsea, should I forbid my daughters from watching your show? And she said, are you kidding? There's no way in the world you can keep them from watching my show.
Right, you can't, right.
That's a parable. There is no way of you know, it's that's what the popular culture is. It is in the air, and nobody can stop it. And then this week we're talking about this. I must say that one of her Kim's tweets got my attention. She said, "People say I have no talent, but you try balancing a wine champagne glass on your rear end. Yeah. I have some talent."
Michael Hirsch, let me ask you on a more serious note. For a brief assessment, there was a story in the Washington Post just in the last 24 hours about very serious allegations against Bill Cosby, who, of course, is a beloved entertainer. Are those being taken seriously?
Well, the Internet's taking them seriously. Obviously, the statute of limitations has run out, but I think that this is the reputation of a guy who's known as America's dad. I don't think that endures. It sounds like these are very credible allegations and very shocking indeed.
Allegations of rape, in fact. Michael Hirsch, national editor from Politico magazine, so nice of you to be with us today.
Thank you, John.
Margaret Talev, White House correspondent for Bloomberg News, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, thanks as always. Stay warm.
Thanks, John.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up on Monday, the Keystone Pipeline is closer than ever to being built. We'll look at the politics and the economics of Keystone. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.